I'm Dean Newland, and welcome to the Business of Intuition, where I coach, facilitate, train, and speak on the hard science and meaningful experience of intuitive leadership in business, so you can make better decisions, forge real connections, and creatively solve problems to amplify your impact and simplify your life. Welcome to the Business of Intuition.
Yesterday was the 4th of July. We had 25 people at our house, inside and out, playing cornhole, ping pong, and having just a wonderful time. Conversations were delightful. Everybody was talking about how nice it was to be back in connection with one another, that we're back to the quote unquote, the way things were. And while I do agree that this is such a wonderful time, I am also very aware of the tendency that I have and others to forget what we went through over the last 18 months. And I don't mean to be a downer, but I want us to be able to remember the lessons learned of the pandemic. And one of them I think that is very strong is how do we build resilient families, communities, and companies? And my next guest on the Business of Intuition is an expert in this. She is a scientist. She's a physician by trade. She has just a wealth of ROI data that proves why resilient programs actually improve performance, retention, and culture. We talked about all sorts of things like what happens in the brain when we become really stressed? What is the cause of burnout? How do we build resilient cultures? What is all about loneliness and how does that relate to our ability to connect to people? And what in particular can we do as individuals, as leaders and teams to be able to make resilience a part of our work, not something separate from our work? She had a great definition for mindfulness, which was, one, being fully present in the moment, and two, coming up with the correct and skillful response to the situation. Parneet Pal was just a delightful gal to have. She is a Harvard and Columbia trained physician working at the intersection of lifestyle medicine, technology, and behavior change. As an educator and science communicator, she applies her subject matter expertise to optimize human health and its impact on business leadership and planetary well-being. She strongly believes that we can create a compassionate, equitable society where health is the default. As chief science officer at Wisdom Labs, she focuses on solving for stress, burnout, and loneliness in the workplace. Wisdom Labs inspires to build wiser workplaces using the science of mindfulness and scaling the skills of mental resilience, emotional intelligence, and compassionate leadership across the organization. I think you'll enjoy this interview. Parneet Pal on the Business of Intuition. Parneet, thank you so much for joining me on the Business of Intuition. It's a delight to have you. And I just wanted maybe to start off with a basic foundational question, kind of from a design thinking perspective. But what problem are you and your company trying to solve?
Thank you, Dean. Lovely to be here on this conversation with you. So our team at Wisdom Labs, we are trying to solve for stress, burnout, and loneliness in the workplace. And you know, when you look at the stats around these issues, I think anyone who works can resonate and identify with these three issues. And I think, you know, with the COVID-19 pandemic, it's definitely accelerated the conversation. It's definitely brought people more into an intuitive, but also a very analytical awareness of what's been happening, what's been simmering all this time, and hopefully drawn a little more attention to the need to address stress, burnout, and loneliness in the workplace and in skillful ways. And at Wisdom Labs, we use the science of mindfulness, resilience, and compassion to do that.
And so have we become more stressed?
Definitely.
Go ahead, please.
I would say definitely, because, you know, if you look at the stats in the US alone, about, you know, a third of people were experiencing symptoms of anxiety and depression because of the pandemic. And even before that, stress levels were extremely high in the workplace, accounting for upwards of $300 billion of money spent because of stress-related illness in the workplace. And, we have to remember that stress accounts not just for the immediate sort of effects of what you feel in the moment and how that shows up in your behavior, which is, of course, really important on teams. But it's also important to keep in mind that stress then becomes the trigger for many different lifestyle-related chronic diseases, you know, things like obesity and diabetes and heart disease and cancer and stroke, which have longer-term effects and longer-term healthcare costs. In fact, 86% of the healthcare costs in the U.S. are because of that go towards the treatment of these chronic lifestyle-related diseases, and a lot of the times workplaces have to burden those costs. So yeah, it's really important to remember that stress has increased, and it has a huge impact on how we work, but also how we show up in everyday lives.
So can stress, in a sense, be after a while a habit, meaning that I've got so used to the adrenaline and the chemical reactions that are happening from the stress, that it to not be stressed, to be calm, to be mindful, almost feels wrong because I've now programmed myself into feeling that stress is now the new normal?
I think so, yes. And I think it becomes familiar, right? So you become, it becomes that feeling of, this is me, you know? So we start labeling ourselves, I'm anxious, or I'm disconnected, or I'm always angry, or I'm frustrated, or I'm insecure, whatever the case might be. And there's some very interesting research, especially from the anxiety point of view. And this is the work of Dr. Judson Brewer and others who've taken a look at how anxiety actually shows up as a worry loop in the brain. So just like any other habits, you know, you might be familiar with the habit loop in the brain, right? You have a habit consists of three things that happen. You know, there's a trigger or an outside stimulus, which results in a particular routine behavior on your side. And then that routine behavior has some kind of reward in the brain, right? And because you get that ping of reward in the brain, that perpetuates a cycle. So the next time that same trigger happens to you, you're more likely to resort to that same behavior. And so what's interesting in this research is that they've figured out that our worry and our anxiety has become this kind of habitual loop that we've become used to. And from the brain's perspective, you know, the trigger is the stress. So whatever's happening right now, the routine behavior, which in the past would have been effective, this is why it became a habit, was our ability to use our prefrontal cortices and think through the problem and analyze it and break it down and problem solve and find out solutions. And so the reward is that, you know, you resolve the problem. And so then the next time you're feeling stressed, your brain is more likely to go into that kind of cognitive analytical problem solving mode. But now when there's a lot of uncertainty happening, so you have stress plus uncertainty, unfortunately, the brain, you know, it goes into action and it says, okay, you know, if this, then what, it starts to, try to figure out many different scenarios. But because there are so many gaps in our knowledge, right, we don't know what's going to happen with COVID, for example. There are still many uncertainties. You know, we don't know what's going to happen with the economy. So no matter how many times you run through those scenarios in the brain, you're not really coming up with a good solution. But the reward then in that case, from the brain's point of view, is the brain still thinks, oh, at least we're doing something. And that's the reward. You know, at some point in the future, I'm going to come to a resolution. But what ends up happening is that we get stuck in these ruminative worry loops. So that's kind of the, you know, from a brain's habitual thinking perspective and sort of what we become familiar with and we almost take for granted. You know, so all that to say, that's an example of what you mentioned, that yes, it, you know, stress can become the scenario that we get really accustomed to very quickly.
And not all stress, tell me if I'm wrong, is bad. I mean, there can be opportunity, there can be momentum, there can be flow, there can be things that are moving us forward, even with a certain amount of certainty, you know, like a new job, or I'm moving to a new city, or there's a brand new baby that just came into our world, or I just got married. These are fun things, but yet there's also a sort of that stress response as well. So how does that work when something positive can be perceived as the brain as a negative stress?
So it depends on your resilience levels. So each of us has what's called a window of tolerance. So in the research, they look at it's the zone where any particular stress that occurs is the kind of stress that you're just describing. It's kind of a challenge stress, right? It's a stress where you get motivated by the challenge, where you feel like, wow, you know, this is an opportunity for me to use my skills and put them into good action. And, you know, we feel we have that drive and that vitality. We engage sort of our drive motivational systems in the brain. So we don't see the situation as threatening necessarily. But anything that goes beyond that window of tolerance is when we go into that threat zone or that threat stress that the brain perceives as something that we can't cope with. And then we go into the fight, flight, and freeze reaction in the brain.
So in a sense, are you making the point that by increasing your tolerance, you increase your resilience?
Exactly. So that's, you know, when we talk about building resilience, we're talking about all the skills and techniques that help you to widen that window of tolerance. So that then, you know, the situations or the people that were stressful before, they stop being stressful.
So I really want to get into the questions about now, how do we go about, you know, building that kind of tolerance and that resilience? But I have another quick question I want to ask you. Yes. So in the executives that we deal with, and I'm sure you've seen this as well, is that, and maybe it's part of our Western culture, it's part of our you know, the great generation, you know, greatest generation that was all about working hard. And that's how you get ahead in life is by working hard, you know. And of course, the words hard already start to indicate what the experience is going to feel like, right? But I noticed of late that there's like, I'm thinking about a group of an executive team I'm dealing with right now, where they're very much aware of the issue that you're describing. I mean, they are a healthcare company and they are talking actively about we need to build more resilient programs into our culture because we see how it's creating an environment where people may not want to stay. Retention levels may be directly connected to burnout and stress. And of course, employees now have options now that they didn't have before. We're in a huge issue with respect to getting talented people. But on the other hand, there's this sort of this, I don't know what it is, it's like a bravado, almost like a badge of honor that I am working, you know, 18 hours a day and I haven't taken a vacation in a year. And it's almost like I know in one hand that stress is not positive. In the other hand, I'm not modeling it very well. So in your organization and your work and your science, how are you able to create the case for why these type A executives need to reevaluate their own behavior around resilience? Because of course, that's going to have a cascading effect for the organization. What's the ROI on why we should be doing this?
Wow, so that's a huge question, but I think
I know.
the one thing that I'll start with is that when we think of resilience in an organization, and I think this is something that, you know, exactly those executive leaders really need to keep in mind. Well, there are many things they need to keep in mind, but one of the things is that resilience depends on individual factors, but it also depends on team and organizational factors. So when we take a look at burnout and the causes of burnout, most of them are organizational. You know, there's a huge misconception around burnout, which is that it's some sort of personal failure or inability of a person to keep up with the demands.
Right.
And that's only part of the equation. So when you look at the research around the causes of burnout, and we can get into those if you'd like, but
yeah, please.
Those are mostly organizational. So I'll speak to that. But then even before that, I just want to acknowledge what you mentioned, which is that there's such a culture of normalizing this kind of, you know, I'll sleep when I'm dead kind of bravado.
Right.
But from you know, the research clearly shows, you know, beyond 55 hours, for example, per week of work, there's no significant increase in productivity. In fact,
diminishing returns, even really.
Exactly, diminishing returns.
Okay.
And then, I mean, you can, you know, there are some, you can do a few sprints once in a while, but you can't expect your brain and body to function at its best without the kind of restoration that it needs, whether it comes to your focus, your productivity, your creativity, your ability. So for example, if you've been sleep deprived, even for one night, you know, just if you get 5 or 6 hours of sleep, it increases or lowers the threshold of your limbic systems, your amygdala, by about 60%, something to that effect, which means that if you haven't slept well, you're very easily emotionally triggered the next day. And I think we've all experienced that, right? We haven't slept and we go into a meeting and somebody says something and we find we're really edgy. And you know, we often say and do things that we regret later. And that's just from a lack of one night of sleep. And you can imagine if this happens on a regular basis. And then we, you know, wonder why we have interpersonal conflict and unresolved conflict on teams, of when we have issues with emotional intelligence and not being able to manage our anger and our fear and our frustration and our difficult emotions, and why we're not empathizing with others. So all of these factors require that we get that kind of rest and restoration from a sleep perspective, from other lifestyle perspective. You know, we have to be eating nutritious food and getting enough exercise and movement, but also very importantly, be building on our skills of resilience, which include being a little more mindful and a little more compassionate, hopefully.
So it sounds like part of your work, though, is just to make this case that the mindset around resilience is actually good business.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, if you look at, you know, we can think about many research findings, including, I'm sure you're familiar with the Google Aristotle Project. I'm sure you've talked about that before. But for those listeners who are not familiar with it, you know, Google did this huge research study amongst, I think it was more than 180 teams, I think, globally. And they studied almost every single factor that contributes to the effectiveness of the team. And they were really surprised by the findings, because what they found is that the number one factor in the most effective teams was not related to the skill or expertise level, but it was related to whether or not those teams were psychologically safe. And when you think about what makes a team psychologically safe, it comes down to the ability to listen and to empathize with your teammates and to be able to build that kind of trust. So for, I think when organizations are thinking about return on investment and why they need to help their teams be more resilient and empathic and compassionate, well, those are the most effective teams that are able to do that.
Right. Perfect. Wonderful. I'm glad you mentioned that. So why do mindfulness programs in organizations fail?
Mindfulness programs fail for the same reason that any other wellness program fails in an organization. So whether it's a nutrition program or fitness program or any other kind of wellness associated initiatives, the number one reason is that these programs are often that fail. They lack, first of all, the kind of depth or, you know, just from a content and skill perspective that might be missing. They may not have the most appropriate evidence-based content. Mm-hmm. But the second and more important reason is that there often isn't the kind of leadership buy-in that would make these programs successful in a company. So often they're sort of just, you know, they're just checking the box and you're just offering a mindfulness program or any other wellness program, you know, so that you can say that you've taken this initiative without really integrating it into the language and the culture and the overall strategy in an organization. So, you know, if the leaders that are driving these programs do not believe in their efficacy or do not believe in their value, it's very hard for teams to start integrating them effectively. So a lot of the times we find that just because that kind of buy-in is not present, you know, then that just translates into the kinds of communications that happen around these programs, and which obviously affects the uptake from employees. Because you have to keep in mind, you know, employees right now are, you know, their schedules are crazy, right? Mm-hmm. They're often double booked for meetings. They have, you know, back-to-back meetings. There's hardly any time for taking a break. And then if you just sort of say, oh, and by the way, you know, here's go check out this wellness program in your spare time, you know, that's not going to happen, right?
Yeah.
Even when we have, that's just human behavior. Even when we have the best of intention for ourselves, you know, think about the last diet that you wanted to include or the exercise program that you wanted to incorporate just on your own.
Right.
You know, our motivation really varies through the day. We, you know, if you have the choice between finishing a project deadline versus taking care of your health, unfortunately, the project will always win. And so for wellness programs or mindfulness programs to be effective, they have to be integrated into the everyday activities. You know, can employees learn to start every meeting with a couple of minutes of mindfulness? Is the language and the science of mindfulness articulated so that folks are aware of, you know, why should I even be investing 5 or 10, 15 minutes a day into these practices? Well, if you look at the science and you look at the benefits that you get from your ability to focus better, to be more creative, to be more emotionally intelligent, to be more empathic and compassionate, then get motivated and curious about doing these programs.
It sounds kind of like what you just said reminds me of Stephen Covey's work long, long time ago, you know, when he had the four quadrants and you'd have urgent and important be quadrant one, and you have important and not urgent in quadrant two. And it sounds like mindfulness and the way we see it is, yeah, I know it's important, but I got 40 emails coming at me and I got a boss who wants a report by Tuesday. So that's urgent and important. So thank you very much. I will do my little meditation later if I ever do that. So you're saying you got to build it into the daily habits of your team. What's like an idea? I love the idea. Like, I think meeting management is a fascinating study and I've been looking into this for years, but what can we do as part of our meetings? Mm-hmm. That is a way to bring mindfulness into the conversation and into the team, into the culture.
Beautiful. I love that you're even thinking of that. So with it in a meeting, there are several things you can do. One is, how are you preparing for the meeting? So the mindfulness can start even before the meeting has started. Is what is your state of mind and body as you go into, whether it's that Zoom call or in-person meeting? And so just taking a few minutes even to focus, you know, take a few deep breaths, keeping your exhale a little bit longer than your inhale, which sort of calms your sympathetic nervous system, right? So it stimulates your parasympathetic, your rest and digest system. So your heart rate goes down, your breathing slows down, your muscles relax. And from the brain's point of view, it sort of widens your perspective a little bit more, rather than being sort of really at that kind of tunnel vision that we develop when we're stressed all the time. So imagine if everyone coming into a meeting, instead of being frazzled and feeling chaotic, came in slightly more focused with a slightly wider perspective and ready to engage with the topic of the meeting. So that's something that folks can do, maybe take a couple of minutes or 5 minutes, whatever time you have before. And then at the start of the meeting, everyone can, you know, actually spend 1 or 2 minutes in silence or just play a guided meditation. And, you know, on the Wisdom Labs, we have a Wise at Work app where we have literally meeting starters. So these are very secular guided practices just to, you know, with different focuses, right? So there are practices that help you be more creative. There are practices that help you feel more connected to your teammates so that you collaborate better. So there's a wide variety of what you can do to sort of set the tone. But then during the meeting itself, what can you mindfully listen to when somebody is speaking, rather than sort of, you know, in your mind, and we all do this, is we're so focused on our reply or, you know, the brilliant thing that we are going to say next. And we often miss what somebody else is saying. And, you know, mindful listening is important, not for many different reasons. It's really important to develop empathy, to really be able to see the other person's perspective on your team so that you can then collaborate better. But I think even from a culture building or team bonding perspective, you know, one of the most basic human needs is a need to be seen and heard and appreciated. Mm. And it's really hard to do that if you're not listening to what your teammate has to say. And even if you don't have to agree with them all the time, but just to be able to hear their point of view and include them in the conversation. And, you know, one other thing that can be done in meetings, and we actually do this in the organizations that we work with, but also at Wisdom Labs, is once in a while, we'll just go around and just, you know, say one thing that we're grateful for, which is a very quick gratitude practice, but it's a very practical way to include the science of gratitude, which has been shown to be extremely helpful when it comes to building our resilience. So just, you know, and now, especially during the pandemic, what we've heard from many different organizations is that the teams that were able to navigate this adversity in skillful ways are the ones that took the time to say, wait a second, before we get to the agenda, how are you? You know, how are you doing? So yeah. That, you know, even those little moments of check-in can be very powerful ways to engage in that kind of mindful awareness and listening.
I love it. I just think that's great. So you mentioned early on, Parneet, about loneliness. Mm-hmm. You know, that was one of the three things I think you started off our conversation with. Speak to that and how it relates to your work, your company's work, and how it connects to resilience.
So again, loneliness is a huge topic, but what we know is, unfortunately, loneliness levels have been rising consistently. Mm-hmm. And 61% of Americans, in a huge survey that was done by Cigna in 2020, reported feeling lonely. And wow. This is exactly, and it happens at all levels in the workplace. So again, there was a Harvard Business Review study a few years ago among CEOs that reported that 50% of CEOs reported feeling lonely, and 61% of them said that it impacted the work that they were doing. And loneliness is this sense, loneliness is not about a feeling, it's not about being physically isolated. It's not about being by yourself or, being in solitude. It does not refer to the quantity of your relationships. It refers to the quality of your relationships. So do you feel that the relationships that you have fulfill your intimate and social needs? And if that's missing, then we qualify that person to say, that person is experiencing loneliness. And the reason that it's important in the workplace is because when we feel lonely, we trigger the same kind of fight or flight response in our body as when we're experiencing any other kind of stress. And that has a huge impact on our performance. So people who are lonely at work because they're feeling isolated, they're less productive, they're less creative. They don't have that kind of commitment to the organization that you would want. They don't identify with the mission because they don't feel part of the team. But then from a health standpoint, loneliness has huge ramifications. So it's, again, it contributes to all of those lifestyle-related chronic diseases, but especially it's a huge risk factor for depression and dementia and heart disease. So many, so at Wisdom Labs, we see that all of this, the stress and the loneliness and the anxiety, and this kind of disconnection, again, accelerated by the pandemic, where we've all been working from home, we haven't been able to meet our teams, we haven't been able to travel. So not only have we been socially isolated, but it has also contributed to us feeling lonely. And one way that we address that is, mindfulness practices and compassion practices have been shown to strengthen a particular network in the brain called the pro-sociality network. And this is a network that allows us to connect with others, to be kind, to be generous, to be empathic, and helps us to build those kinds of meaningful relationships. So that's, one way, one practice that we can all engage in to overcome some of the loneliness that we're feeling. But very importantly, our programs use communities to strengthen mindfulness practice. So we realize that, again, from a habit perspective, it's really hard to develop a new habit by yourself. I mean, there are some people who do that really well. Most of us need some support. And so we have a program called Wise at Work Communities, where we have team members coming together. We provide the content, everybody comes together, learns and practices together, but very importantly has a conversation related to the topic. And this is a time where they check in with each other and they see how the other person is doing and they see how those practices might actually show up in their everyday lives and how they can support one another. And so we found that that's really helpful to improve that sense of connection between teams.
So you're in that, obviously, just not just the technology, the apps that one could have to help them on an individual level, but it sounds like, I'm just repeating what you said, that you're creating these communities to address this issue around loneliness and connectivity. So the irony, of course, is that a lonely person wants connection, but their loneliness in some ways is also creating the conditions by which they would be disconnected. So it's this sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, this loop.
Yes. And that's something that I think all leaders need to keep in mind. And the first thing that you can do to address that is to raise that level of awareness amongst your team members. So, if you're feeling lonely, and, we can understand it through an evolutionary lens, is when we were, hundreds of thousands of years ago out in the wild living as, within tribes, if for whatever reason you found yourself isolated from the tribe, say you lost your way, you probably would not survive, right? Out on your own in the wild. And so the body had to come up with this signaling system to say, hey, watch out, this is a dangerous situation, go find your tribe. And that's the stimulation of the fight or flight stress response whenever we're feeling lonely. So now in the 21st century, you know, we might be surrounded by lots of people. We might be in an urban setting or in a workplace setting. But if we don't have that kind of meaningful connection with anyone on our teams, it's kind of like being lost and having lost your tribe. And so it triggers that same feeling. But the way that it manifests in your, the way that you show up with your team is just as you would in the wild. So it makes you anxious. It makes you really self-protective. You get into a very sort of defensive self-preservation mode. You might even be a little hostile, right? You're protecting yourself from that tiger outside. And again, all of this is happening very unconsciously. You know, so the lonely person is yearning for connection. However, their brain is in that state of stress, their responses often come across as somebody that you might think, oh, that person is very aloof. They're very abrupt. They're a little bit hostile. I don't want to connect with them. You know, I don't want to approach them. And unfortunately, as you said, that kind of aggravates the loneliness. So I think one of the things that leaders can do and teams can do is just to be aware that this might be happening. So rather than thinking of a team member as somebody who is not friendly or who is aggressive or hostile, maybe they're just lonely. And to just sort of start to expand your perspective and understanding, and then create situations or opportunities for meaningful connection. And of course, that will vary depending on the organization, but even the ability to have one-on-one conversations with that person, you know, with their manager, or just giving them an opportunity to engage in cognitive behavioral therapy or mindfulness and compassion practices. Both these have been shown to be really helpful from that individual's point of view. But even making these practices available in the first place and to talk about this, to normalize it, you know, again, luckily now, I think because of the pandemic, we've taken some steps to kind of normalize the stigma around mental health. And, you know, loneliness is a huge part of that mental health equation. So I think even just talking about it in an organization and making it known that, you know, this could be happening and we're aware of it, but also that we've all gone through it. I mean, I think, you know, every single person that I've spoken to, myself included, we've experienced periods of loneliness or moments of loneliness in our lives. And so just like with other aspects of mental health, to talk openly about it, I think starts to begin to create that environment where people can feel safe enough to start having those conversations.
Yeah, I was reflecting on what you were saying, and, you know, today is the 5th of July, yesterday was the 4th, and, you know, where I live, everybody was back to interacting. You know, streets were full of kids, people were having parties in their backyards, barbecues were, you know, doing their thing, and restaurants were to capacity. And so there was this common conversation like, wow, we're back to where we were, right?
Yeah.
And yet I think that there's something so refreshing about that. There's a sense of relief, you know, we can reconnect. So on one hand, I see this loneliness conversation being so important because now we're able to sort of physically reconnect. But on the other hand, there's a mindfulness to say, let's put the pandemic and all that it was aside, and let's start moving back to where things were, in air quotes. And so what I get concerned sometimes is that we don't learn from what we just went through. This last 18 months was rich with things for us to learn, including mindfulness. And I just, I sometimes wonder, are we just gonna go back to where we were at the beginning of 2020, where at least in my life, I was at a fever pitch, almost to the point where I was loving the amount of work and the travel that was going on, but it felt unsustainable. It felt like, you know, the pitch was so high that I wouldn't be able to continue doing that. And so I just hope that we don't miss this opportunity to go, yeah, we're getting back to reconnecting physically, but let's not lose the opportunity to reassess what we just learned here.
I love what you said, Dean, and I really hope everyone listens to that and pays attention to your recommendation there. Absolutely. You know, this kind of new normal is something that again, every team and culture will have to figure out for themselves. I think already I've been noticing there's, you know, some anxiety around this hybrid way of working. You know, what will the future of work look like? Nobody knows. Yeah. And I think, you know, the Great Pause has given us an opportunity to figure out what's important to us. And I think one of the lessons of mindfulness is that it allows you to connect with a sense of meaning and purpose in your life. So I think the one thing that teams and organizations can do, even before engaging in any kind of formal practice, is to start having these conversations around, you know, what is meaningful to us? What is the purpose of our lives? And how do the values of our organization or the mission of our organization align to those kinds of values? What's important to our teams? And just starting to have these conversations can then sort of build and give space for many different techniques like mindfulness and compassion, which are sort of the fuel for your brain and your body for that kind of restoration, but also that kind of attention that you need to pay to be able to, you know, be mission aligned, to show up connected to your values, and to take the kinds of courageous actions that we all need to take. I mean, when you step back and look at the state of the world, it's, you know, we have plenty of crises to keep all of us busy, right, for the next 1,000 years.
At least until next Tuesday, yeah.
Exactly. And so, but again, like you said, this could be a really motivating challenge stress for all of us. You know, how can we bring all of our skills online to contribute in some meaningful way to solve, you know, the health crisis, the climate crisis, the economic inequality crisis? How can business become a force for good? I mean, hopefully these are the kinds of conversations that could happen in organizations as we sort of go back to this new normal.
Yes. And so this, again, this is why this conversation I think is so timely and so perfect, is that, again, let's not lose this opportunity. Let's not just go back to where we were. Let's take this and move it into the new normal. And it's going to take some strong leaders, it sounds like, and strong leadership and strong individuals to be able to change the conversation and change the mindset to be able to even discuss this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Parnie, this is just fascinating. I really enjoy you. You're just a delightful person to have on this podcast. And I think your work is just so important. Any last thoughts, number one, that you really feel like we should have talked about, but we didn't, just because we've only got a half an hour or so? And then the number two question is, how can people connect to you and your work and your company?
So I'll start with the second one first.
Okay.
if you want to reach me, you connect with me on LinkedIn. But for our work at Wisdom Labs, please go to wisdomlabs.com, and you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook as well at Wisdom Labs Inc. And you know, is there something that I left unsaid? Well, Dean, I could talk for days, but I think. I just want to leave folks with a sense of hope. You know, we've been talking about stress and resilience, and I think, you know, one of the important principles of resilience is that we have very little control over what happens externally, but we have 100% control over how we show up in every situation. And so my encouragement to everyone is to use this opportunity and this ability and look into, examine how you can use the skills of mindfulness and compassion. By the way, mindfulness, you know, we didn't talk about it, but it's a very simple way of looking at life. So mindfulness just consists of two things. One, are you paying full attention to whatever's happening in this moment, right? So that's the first thing. Or is your mind lost in thoughts of the past or thoughts of the future, which is a very natural tendency of the mind. But when we practice, we become better and better at staying present. And the whole point of staying present is that then you can see clearly, you know, whatever, everything, the good, the bad, the ugly of the situation in front of you. And then the second step of mindfulness, and this is something that people, even in the mindfulness conversation, often forget to talk about, is now that you've paid attention, what are you going to do next? So how can you respond skillfully? And that skillful response, I think, translates into every aspect of our lives. So in our personal lives, in our work lives, how we show up for businesses, how we show up for the planet. And so I think, again, for me, I get excited about these topics because I feel that we have such an amazing scientifically based resource and technique that's available to all of us. And so my encouragement would be, get curious about it and see how mindfulness and compassion practice can enable you to show up in the world and have the kind of impact that you want to.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Just really good stuff. Really good stuff. Parnie, thank you so much for being a guest on this show. I really appreciate your energy, your insights, your wisdom, your thought leadership, and I just wish you and your company all the best.
Thank you so much, Dean. It's been an absolute delight.
Thank you for listening to The Business of Intuition. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about Dean or Mission Facilitators Leadership, go to mfileadership.com. That's mfileadership.com.